Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, temporary urbanism.
I think it's difficult to imagine a parliamentary democracy happening outside that building, but certainly we have a 6 to 10 year period when it won't be usable.
It's not all about pop-up cafes and gathering a couple of neighbours to set up a street market. Temporary urbanism can have a huge impact in cities, allowing planners to push some of their bolder and more unusual ideas through the bureaucracy of City Hall. Sometimes it all comes down to necessity, as is the case in the UK, where MPs are going to have to move to a temporary parliament for a while. On other occasions, it's all about giving a fresh face to a square, a park, or perhaps a garden. Join us as we explore some of these themes over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. Being able to use something that's non-permanent is a useful asset for any mayor, planner or developer. It's not often that a city gets a chance to, well, just try something out and then knock it down once they've done with the experiment. From tactical urbanism interventions to greener approaches to public space and blending that line between private and public, temporary urbanism is a growing trend in the cities of today. So let's start the show in London, where over the past couple of months there's been an ongoing debate about where to house the members of parliament while the Palace of Westminster is getting some much needed repair work. Earlier, Monocle's Carlotta Rebello caught up with David Rudlin, who's the chairman of the Academy of Urbanism, to hear how this is an opportunity to not only reimagine an iconic symbol of British democracy, but also to help reshape the way that politics is done in the nation. They started by talking about why MPs have to move out of the Houses of Parliament in the first place.
The Parliament building, which is a wonderful building, but hasn't really been refurbished for many, many years, is in a parlous state, and it's a fire risk, its services need upgrading, and the cost and the time taken to refurbish it means it will be out of commission for years. So I think it's difficult to imagine a parliamentary democracy happening outside that building, but certainly we have a 6 to 10 year period when it won't be usable.
Now, as you mentioned, it is a big project for anyone tackling it, this refurbishment, but it hasn't been decided yet where MPs will actually be working from during those 6 to 10 years. A few ideas suggest that maybe it could be floating around the Thames. What do you make of some of these suggestions for the Parliament?
I think the suggestion is that if the MPs stay in place, it will take much longer to refurbish. And so it'll be more than 10 years if they try and do it while they're still occupying the building. And so the most efficient way of doing it would be to move out, to move somewhere else and to allow the refurbishment to go ahead unimpeded. And that then raises the prospect about where do you move to? And maybe you move out to another city in the meantime, which I think is a very interesting one.
Well, moving out to another city would, of course, help to balance the shift that a lot of people feel, this shift of power that is too concentrated in London.
This is the fundamental problem we have as a nation, is that we do everything in London. It's the centre for financial life, it's the centre for our media, it's the centre for our arts and culture, and of course it's also the centre for democracy. Whereas if you're in Germany, you know, Berlin is where government takes place, Frankfurt is where finance takes place, and Hamburg is where the media and culture take place, and you therefore get a much greater variety of very strong cities in a country like that. And the same is true in America and the same is true in Australia and other countries. Whereas in Britain, we pressurise everything into a single city. And it's much to the detriment of those activities, which, you know, try and take place in an incredibly expensive, crowded city of London. So actually moving the Parliament out to Birmingham or to Manchester or to Leeds would be a very important step. And actually one would think maybe not even a temporary one.
How likely do you think then, if you just keep looking at a temporary one, that is to happen, that instead of trying to find another solution here in London, either find one elsewhere or use an existing structure in one of the cities you just mentioned?
Well, I think it's one of those incredibly practical suggestions which makes a huge amount of sense, which will be undermined by emotion and the wishes of the MPs to be in London and so on. So I'm not actually that optimistic. I think that the MPs will think they couldn't possibly do what they do in another city other than London. And of course, they're wrong. I'd be very surprised, actually, if they did decide to move to somewhere like Birmingham. I think even though I think it makes perfect sense to do so.
Now, thinking about that temporary structure here in London, how do you think it would impact the city? London doesn't need any more tall structures to populate at least the area around the river. The idea of a floating parliament seems too utopian for many. Is it just about using a building that already exists and shuffling people around, essentially?
If you're going to do it in London, I mean, there was a very good analogy for this, which is the media centre that was built for the Olympics in 2012, which was an enormous building to house the world's media for, you know, the duration of the Games, which was a very short period of time. And that enormous structure has since been developed into a whole series of things, into TV studios and creative workspace and all sorts of things happen in that building. But it was built as a temporary structure for a very short period of time. So it is possible to do these things and possible to create somewhere. I mean, what's interesting, you know, in Manchester, where I'm based, the architecture school moved out of their building into a temporary structure for a period of 3 years while they refurbished the building. And what they found was all sorts of different ways of working started to emerge, and different relationships between people happened because the space that you're in determines the way that you work. And actually, we'd find this with Parliament. You know, if we had a different debating chamber, we'd very soon get a very different type of democracy. And I think it's a real opportunity to experiment with those things.
I was going to just touch upon that point. Temporary urbanism is associated with experimentation and often can prove to be a good way to test things in city, even if they don't work, at least to figure that out. Do you think here we might be having a missed opportunity if the debate is too concentrated in London and something that is indeed temporary, to actually be able to build something that then can be adapted and have a different life after it stops being a parliament?
It's a real opportunity, isn't it, to say, well, why don't we move Parliament to another city? Why don't we stick it in a different type of structure so MPs can be working more closely? I mean, currently MPs are, you know, spread all over around Parliament in cubbyholes and small offices and so on. And some of them have lovely offices in the Grimshaw building, but many of them are sort of stuck away in various places. And to have an open democracy where they can work together in an open democratic building might completely change the way that they work. And if you can't do that as an experiment for 4 or 5 years while the refurbishment goes on, then you never will do it. This is the big opportunity to try that experiment.
Now, you mentioned when a temporary structure was then adapted and now has a different life. What do you think people should do with the structure for the parliament once the work is done?
I think there are all sorts of things. I mean, the point about modern buildings is they can be incredibly flexible. And so, you know, the original parliamentary building is actually very fixed because it's a structure which doesn't, can't be knocked about very much internally. But modern buildings, you can reconfigure and change. And so you could do all sorts of things with them. And the great thing about temporary urbanism in cities is space which isn't massively expensive. It doesn't involve a huge commitment. So if you want to do something interesting or entrepreneurial or creative in a city, you don't want to sign a 20-year lease on a space that you're stuck with for that time. You want something flexible and open. And you, with a new parliament committee, if it was paid for by the parliament, you'd have a huge structure which would become a massive opportunity to allow things to experiment in and to allow things to happen. And I think that's the great advantage. If you build something fresh, you've got to make your money back on the building that you're creating. But if you build it with something else and then repurpose it afterwards, it becomes much more flexible.
You mentioned at the beginning of this chat, you were describing how the Houses of Parliament are, the Palace of Westminster. And it is a building that visually, it's very significant and immediately associated with democracy in the UK. And it's difficult to imagine MPs deliberating elsewhere. How do you think this new temporary structure should look? Should it try to replicate that same grandeur, or should it actually be a clean slate and allow for some experimentation in that sense as well, of what sort of building it is?
I think we don't do modern buildings with the same grandeur as the Victorians did. I mean, there's a very analogous situation that Manchester Town Hall is about to be refurbished. And if you know Manchester Town Hall, it is the most beautiful, overblown Victorian building. And we all love it because of that. But you would never build that again. I mean, the cost of these Victorian buildings was so exorbitant compared to modern prices. So it's simply not conceivable that you'd build something with that grandeur. You'd build something much more functional. And I think you'd make a benefit from that function and to make it into something which then allows things to happen more efficiently. Of course, you go to the Scottish Parliament, and there's an interesting sort of reimagining of what a parliament might be by Morales up there. And, you know, it's interesting when you see the way that Scottish democracy works, which is actually quite different to English democracy in that respect. I think you'd do something much more functional, much more efficient in terms of the way that it works. And you'd see how that changed the way our democracy works.
Are there any other examples from around the world that might come to mind to you about how actually the way these parliaments are designed, and not talking just about temporary ones, can actually affect the way democracy operates?
Well, I guess the big one would be the Bundestag in Germany, wouldn't it, which was done by Fosters and was very much designed in terms of visibility and the public being able to see democracy happening, which, of course, you don't get in Westminster at all. You have it on TV, but there's no way that you can go and observe it. The mayoral building in London was done with a similar idea that you could have sort of visible democracy. But I think, you know, those are good examples of people trying to rethink the way that a democratic institution works.
That was the chairman of the Academy of Urbanism, David Rudlin, and he was speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Rebello. We now shift our gaze towards the Olympic infrastructure. As more and more cities around the world grapple with the high costs of hosting the Olympic Games, the International Olympic Committee has been struggling to find cities who are even willing to host the mega sporting event. To help with that search, the Games are now asking host cities to be more sustainable by creating sporting venues that are temporary and can be repurposed into other infrastructure after the Games are done. For example, at London 2012, 25 venues of the 140 required were temporary. And Rio 2016 then followed suit at the last Summer Olympics, where several structures were set to be repurposed into schools after the last medals were handed out. Monocle's contributing editor, Sheena Roster, was in Rio at the time, and she tells us what's left of the Rio 2016 Olympics in the Brazilian city.
I have the honour to announce that the Games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
It would be a first. The first city to host a South American Olympic Games, and it would go to Rio de Janeiro in 2016. Brazilians celebrated across the country with the announcement and the idea that the Latin American giant could be seen on a global stage. But the joy quickly came crashing down to earth when the cost for hosting the mega sporting event began to roll in.
Somado tudo que a prefeitura do Rio gastou em saúde e educação, de 2009 até agora, quando a gente ganhou a Olimpíada, incluindo 2016.
Former Rio de Janeiro mayor Eduardo Paes was adamant that this would be a sustainable Games. Not a penny would be wasted and no white elephants. Rio had already been down this road before, after all, when it hosted the Pan American Games back in 2007. After those venues went unused and poorly built infrastructure crumbled, Brazilians were skeptical. But the Olympics would be different, officials promised. These games would only use private funds, and several of the venues, like the Aquatic Center, would be repurposed for a public pool. And the Olympic handball venue would be transformed into four public schools, improving the country's poor educational system. This would be sustainable and create a legacy.
Condições de prestar serviço de saúde, saúde de educação, serviço de educação.
Repurposing venues in Rio would prevent mistakes that were made by Athens in 2004, where venues were left to decay as Greece struggled with a debt crisis. It would also prevent problems like those in Beijing, where the Bird's Nest Stadium cost around $11 million to maintain each year, even though it mostly sits empty. In the end, even if these venues were repurposed, the Rio 2016 Olympics was a mixture of private and public funds, and it cost $13.1 billion. Those are some pretty expensive schools and public pools. With costs that ballooned to an astronomical figure like $13 billion, Rio de Janeiro State was broke before the Games even begun. The Olympic legacy body didn't anticipate Olympic-sized costs for necessary infrastructure like the anti-doping lab, the subway expansion, and cleaning up the city's polluted Guanabara Bay, which was an Olympic venue for sailing. another issue came just 6 months after the Games were over, when these temporary venues weren't being maintained, bringing into question how sturdy these new structures would be that these venues are being turned into. And this brings us back to the fact that Rio de Janeiro State was broke before the Games even started. Brazil is currently going through the worst economic crisis in over 80 years, and the fallout from the Olympics is just one of the contributing factors. Several powerful figures, including the Rio 2016 president Carlos Nuzman and former Rio de Janeiro State governor Sergio Cabral, are behind bars on charges over corruption linked to the Games, among other things. The state has been unable to pay public workers for months, and among those workers are school teachers. So, what good are new schools, many have said, if there's no teachers to teach in them? The idea of repurposing temporary Olympic venues in Rio de Janeiro seems like a great idea on paper. But in practice, and in Brazil, these only cause Olympic-sized problems for the average Brazilian. The 2024 Games in Paris has even promised to be the most sustainable Games ever, looking to veer away from problems that happened in Rio in 2016. How the French capital will be able to do that will be watched closely after Rio's promises of sustainability, at least for the Brazilian financial stability, seemed to be falling short. Now, just weeks away before the next Olympic installment, the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang in South Korea, both Olympic critics and enthusiasts will be watching to see if some of those structures are repurposed to make for more sustainable games and a greater legacy, or if it will be just much of the same with high costs and white elephants. For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
That was Monocle's Sheena Rossiter. She was looking at what's become the legacy and what was just temporary after the Olympics left Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to The Urbanist. At the very heart of city living is a very simple concept, quality of life. But as the worldwide housing crisis deepens, can we rely on temporary solutions to solve such a mammoth issue? Monocle's Carlo Trabello has this week's commentary.
Almost every city around the globe has had its little experiment with temporary urbanism at some point. This growing trend in city planning encompasses everything from pop-up shops and art installations in parks and squares to food markets, quirky restaurants and guerrilla gardening. In an environment ever more dominated by rules and regulations, this is an appealing way of thinking that opens the door for experimentation. It's no wonder that when the sun pops out, so do the pop-ups. Ditching the norm allows for planners and designers to play with public space, rethinking what it could be used for, and sometimes testing the ground for a more permanent solution. And residents take advantage of this concept too, extending the private into the public, transforming car spaces in gardens or cafes, rallying the community around a cause, making use of derelict and neglected spaces. From a distance, when done right, temporary urbanism can have an extremely positive impact in urban living. But it's important to be careful and not use it as a quick fix for existing problems in our cities, let's say, such as housing. This week, the Hong Kong studio James Law Cybertecture unveiled a prototype for low-cost micro-homes using concrete water pipes. The idea would be to stack them up and slot them in between buildings, targeting specifically affordable starter homes for young people. Earlier in the month, the tiny homes builder Escape released the Vista C, a brand new model of a retrofitted shipping container. Others advocate for more ADUs, accessory dwelling units, which are essentially small structures built on the same property of an existing home, meaning that instead of having flatmates, you'd have plotmates. Now, don't get me wrong, all these ideas are valid and welcomed, as cities do need to experiment more, and there is a market for them. But to hail each and every single one of them as the solution to the housing crisis, that is the problem. While they can play a great role in solving one of the most crucial crises in modern era urbanism, we can seriously think that confining the younger generations to an 8-foot-wide home is the only way to make city living a reality. As the year starts and designers, planners and architects from around the world get back on the sketching board, I would urge them all to remember that core word in this concept, temporary. Experiment all you want. Do the wacky things, even if they fail. Just don't fall into the trap of making these solutions permanent, acting as a mere band-aid to a problem that needs an actual intervention. From Monocle, I'm Carlotta Rabello.
And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, a little tribute. Here's The Cranberries with Linger. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.